President Trump has urged Vice President Pence to take an active role and send the electoral votes back to the states. Does he have a constitutional right? Does he have the power to do that? If the election in Georgia goes the way it looks like it's going and the Senate is split 50-50, does Vice President Harris, who presides over the Senate, have the power to cast the deciding vote not only on legislation, but on confirmation of nominees? And what do you think of the fact that President-elect Biden has nominated a surprising choice for Attorney General of the United States? I love it. I wonder if you will. On the Durst Show, and we'll also have a new set of questions on Rumble, because we debuted on Rumble yesterday, and I'm taking today questions only from Rumble viewers. All on the Durst Show coming up. Today, we're going to have a constitutional law seminar on the role of the Vice President of the United States as the President of the Senate. Why? Why today? Because two things are happening. Number one, the Senate will now be tied 50-50. And therefore, Vice President-elect Harris will be the President of the Senate and will be casting probably many deciding votes to break the tie among 50 Republicans and 50 Democrats. But also today, Vice President Pence will preside over the United States Senate as a joint session of Congress opens and reads the votes of the electors to determine the President of the United States on January 20th. Of course, President Trump thinks that the Vice President has the authority to actually send the elector and the electoral votes back to the states and not accept them. A majority in the House and the Senate almost certainly believe the opposite. And so we'll be talking about the role of the Vice President. And indeed, one of the first deadlocks that may have to be decided, I hope not, but may have to be decided by the new Senate, is going to be President-elect Biden's brilliant, brilliant nomination of Merrick Garland to be the Attorney General of the United States. Boy, I'll tell you, if karma has a place somewhere in the world, this is karma. Merrick Garland had his place on the Supreme Court stolen from him by the Republicans, particularly by the majority leader of the Senate, who refused to bring his nomination to a vote. And now he's going to be made Attorney General of the United States and maybe appointed to the Supreme Court when the first vacancy occurs in the Biden administration. Who knows? But if the confirmation vote goes along party lines, and I hope it won't, I think that you're going to be hearing some Republicans who will vote for Merrick Garland. I suspect that Mitt Romney will vote for Merrick Garland and others. But if they don't, then the tie vote will be decided by the then Vice President of the United States, Vice President Harris. Now, you know, there's some dispute, but there's not much of it, about whether the Vice President gets to break a tie over the confirmation of a justice. I'll read you the text of the Constitution. You decide for yourself, but seems probable. It says, "The Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided." Now, clearly, if you go back to the debates about the Constitution, what the framers had in mind is the deciding vote will be cast by the President of the Senate in case they are equally divided over legislation, over laws that are passed. There was no discussion about whether or not the Vice President gets to cast a vote to break a tie about a confirmation. There is an argument that a confirmation requires a majority, and if it's tied, it's not a majority. But I think in the end, although there's no real precedent for that, there is precedent. There have been some votes broken on confirmations, but never has the issue been raised. I suspect that the issue will be resolved by allowing the Vice President to break the tie. So there are two issues before our class today in constitutional law. That is, what is the role of the Vice President in the future when she the first vice president ever to be a she, presides over the United States Senate. There have been presidents pro temp who have been women, but never a president of the Senate who presides. And what will her role be? How many times will she have to cast the deciding vote? How many votes will be 50-50? How much influence will extremists in the Democratic Party have? People like Bernie Sanders, who could prevent a 50-50 vote and hold out. Will he have increased influence as the result of the tie in the Senate? Will Republicans like Mitt Romney, who may cross over, or the senator from Alaska, the senator from Maine, will they have increased influence? These are political issues that need to be resolved. They don't really raise fundamental constitutional questions. So the real question before our seminar today, and I really would love your input on this, the real question is what role the vice president plays in the Electoral College. And the 12th Amendment to the Constitution basically speaks to that. It doesn't say much. It says that the president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, shall, it's not may, it shall, open all of the certificates, and the vote shall then be counted. What does that mean, all of the certificates? What if you have certifications from a state with two slates, as we did in Tilden Hayes, and as some people are claiming we may have today? So the Constitution doesn't really answer that question. But it doesn't give the vice president any special role. He is simply the presiding officer. And if there is a divided vote, he gets to cast the deciding ballot. But in the absence of that, he plays the role of presiding officer. Well, the advocates of a more permissive role say presiding officer can make a lot of decisions. Presiding officer can decide the timing, can decide to allow a vote on creating a commission like the Tilden Hayes Commission. Well, no, I don't think so, because there's another provision of the Constitution that's relevant, and it basically says that the Senate and the House shall be the judges of their own rules and shall make up their own rules. And their rules today provide that votes of this kind have to be decided by a majority of the Senate, majority of the House, not by the presiding officer. The presiding officer, under the rules of the Senate, doesn't have much power. In fact, the majority leader, realistically, of the Senate has far more power than the president of the Senate, except when it comes to a divided vote. So in the end, what will happen, by the time you watch this show, it may have happened already, but see if my predictions are right. My predictions have generally been right, because I don't make them on ideological grounds. I make them on based on my expertise and knowledge. My prediction is that my former student, Ted Cruz, by the way, Merrick Garland's also a former student, so I have a lot of stake in this. I have a lot of my former students. Justice Kagan on the Supreme Court is my former student. So they're all over the place. But Ted Cruz, my former student, who was always arguing with me in class, will move for the creation of a commission like the Tilden Hayes Commission. He will cite the precedent. The Tilden Hayes Commission had several members of the House, several members of the Senate, and several members of the Supreme Court. I don't think Supreme Court justices today would serve, or would it be appropriate for them to serve as members of a commission. But he'll cite the precedent. He's very good at citing history. He'll be correct in his citation of history. But then a vote will be called for. The president of the Senate, the vice president of the United States, Pence, will not have the authority simply to create a commission. So there'll be a vote, and there'll be 15, maybe 20, maybe 10 in that range, voting for the creation of a commission, but an overwhelming majority will vote against it. By the way, I think commission's a great thing for the future. I think for future elections, we ought to now, or next month, or 6 months from now, set up an election commission consisting of former presidents of universities, high-ranking former justices of the Supreme Court, former judges, people of incredible respect, who would have an advisory role, so that if people complain about an election, the issue could be brought to them. They can at least make a recommendation so we don't have to listen to Fox and CNN and decide who's telling the truth. We can listen to somebody who or a group of people who seem to be nonpartisan and unbiased. But that doesn't mean that should be done now for this election. So we'll have a separate vote in the Senate. We'll have a separate vote in the House. It's conceivable there may be a joint session. The joint session is supposed to, according to the Constitution, only open and read the electoral ballots. But there's some room for flexibility and there's some room for majorities to make decisions. But at the end of the day, there will be motions to reject the votes in Michigan and Pennsylvania and perhaps Georgia and maybe other states, enough to make the difference in the election. And those votes will almost certainly lose. So, as I've said before, the Trump team may have the better of the constitutional argument in some respects. For example, they do have the better of the constitutional argument in Pennsylvania. President Trump today, in his speech to large crowds, talked about the people whose votes were counted in Pennsylvania, although the ballots were received after the legislative deadline. So they have a strong constitutional argument on that issue. But he also said there were 10,000 votes. It's not enough. So the theory is on the side of the Trump team. The Constitution may be, in some respects, on the side of the Trump team. But the numbers are not on their side. The numbers of senators, the numbers of congressmen, the numbers of voters, the margin of victory between Biden and Trump is generally greater than the constitutional challenges. Now, the challenges that are more general in terms of computer fraud, those number in the hundreds of thousands, maybe in the millions. And those are evidentiary issues, not number issues. But in general, the stronger the constitutional argument, the fewer the numbers. And the greater the numbers, the weaker the constitutional argument. So that creates a dilemma for, I think, the Trump supporters. So we're seeing a stress test. I've used that term before. I think it's a good term. We're seeing a stress test of the Constitution. We're seeing the terms of the Constitution stretched and tugged and pulled and stretched, not quite to the breaking point, but stretched and tested. And in the end, the Constitution is doing a great job. It will survive. We will have the debates. The Republican senators will have their moments. They will be able to make their arguments. They'll be able to present their evidence. They will be allowed a number of hours to present their point of view. And in the end, the majority will prevail. And there'll be a vote. And the vote will be insufficient for the Republicans to delay the deadline for voting. And, of course, the deadline for President Trump leaving office is constitutionally mandated. There's no flexibility there. On January 20th at noon, the term of the president ends. Even if it were, God forbid, a nuclear explosion or a pandemic that killed most of our population, the term of the president doesn't get extended, as it does in many other countries. The term of the president ends. And at that point, if there is no president, there are laws as to who becomes president. But it's not the former president. He's out of the running. It has to be the order of succession. So under the Constitution, President Trump's term ends on January 20th at noon, and there will be a new president. It will be Joe Biden, but if you follow the Constitution and the law, it is conceivable it could be Nancy Pelosi. It could be who knows. But it can't be Donald Trump. There's no constitutional route other than him being declared the winner of the election, which would have to be done today. But there's no other constitutional route to remaining in office after January 20th. So that's my constitutional lesson for the day. You are now in the company of Elena Kagan. You are now in the company of Merrick Garland. You are now my students. I have given you my lesson. Now, of course, when I taught law at Harvard, much of the class was taken up with Socratic dialogue back and forth. I would ask questions to which there were no right answers. That was the key in my class. Nobody in 50 years of my teaching at Harvard ever gave the right answer to a question. Every question begot another question. Every question raised more questions than it resolved because I had a position. If there was an answer to a question, look it up in the book. You don't need me as a teacher. I'm getting paid a lot of money to teach you. You're paying a lot of money in tuition. Don't waste my time, and I'm not going to waste your time as a teacher telling you something you can look up, telling you something you already know, telling you something you can find out by going online. No, I'm going to ask you questions to which there are no good answers. So you're not getting that part of my teaching, although you can ask me questions to which there are no good answers. And in fact, let's now turn to questions. But we have a very, very special announcement today. As I mentioned yesterday, for those of you who listened, we are now on a Rumble. Yesterday, the Dirt Show celebrated its inaugural run on this new free speech platform, Rumble. And in less than one day, more subscribers have joined the Dirt Show on Rumble than did on YouTube in 2 weeks. So I am thrilled to be on Rumble, and in appreciation for Rumble and the people who run it and the people in the Rumble community. Today, we're responding to comments on our Rumble page in a new segment, which I call, although my son-in-law invented the term, I have to give him the credit, which I call Rumble Wits. So let's Rumble. So there are a lot of differences between Rumble and the other platforms. The main difference is Rumble doesn't censor. The others do. But another difference is when I get questions on Rumble, I have to read them. So I'm going to read the questions on Rumble, and then I will answer them. And in future shows, we'll have a mix of Rumble questions, YouTube questions, questions on all the platforms. But today's Rumble Day. So here they go. First question from, I can't tell the name, it's Jukaneep. Here's what it says. I have been told that the Democratic Party, especially the far-left wingers, actually have the goal of eliminating or remaking the Constitution. What do you think? Look, there are extremists in the Democratic Party. There are probably some in the Republican Party who would like to eliminate the Constitution. You know, every few years there's a call for a constitutional convention. But what we're seeing now, and relevant to Rumble, is there is a movement on the hard left to abolish the First Amendment. The argument is freedom of speech. Why do we need freedom of speech? We know the truth. Freedom of speech is a patriarchal, right-wing, colonialist, imperialist imposition, giving advantage to people who are have white privilege, and free speech doesn't benefit minorities. Well, you know, go back and read Jefferson, go back and read Madison, and see who free speech was intended to benefit. Yes, minorities, people who didn't have a voice through the media, who didn't have an opportunity, who weren't in the majority. So, yeah, there have always been efforts to abolish the Constitution. They will fail. Our Constitution is the longest enduring Constitution in the history of the world. Imagine only a couple of dozen amendments to a document that was written 240 almost years ago, 230 years ago. And most of the amendments have been, you know, rather technical amendments. Obviously, the Bill of Rights, but the 12th Amendment cleaned up a mess that you all remember from the play Hamilton, a tie election. And then we've obviously enfranchised women. We've enfranchised former slaves. We've enfranchised 18-year-olds. Mostly the amendments have expanded on rights. We've had foolish amendments trying to create prohibition, not allowing people to drink wine or whiskey. They had to be changed and amended. But most of our amendments have been pretty good. So three cheers for the Constitution. It's with us for my lifetime, and I suspect the lifetimes of all of my viewers and listeners. Okay, let's turn to the next question. I'm not going to read the names because there are all these funny names that are basically code names and they don't tell us really who the person is. Have you listened to the rest of the Democratic Party espousing hate? You'd think this guy in Georgia was the first horrible person to run in the Democratic Party. It's full of them, idiot. I guess they're calling me an idiot. Look, I am very upset that I had to choose. I didn't vote in Georgia, but in terms of my support, my political contributions. I had to choose between the current majority leader of the Senate and Senator Warnock. I didn't like that choice. I'm a liberal Democrat. Yeah, I generally will support the Democratic candidates for the Senate, but I didn't want to support a candidate who looked me in the eye, basically, and said to me and to you, I saw, he said, I saw. He actually said, we saw, because he was talking about a group. Total lie. We saw the Israeli government shooting down unarmed Palestinian brothers and sisters like birds of prey. Hey, he wasn't there. He didn't see anything. He was not anywhere where there was shooting, and that's been proved. So he lied. And then the blood libel, saying that Israelis shoot down unarmed Palestinians for sport, like birds of prey. I find it very hard to vote for a person like that. And so the Democrats put me to a terrible, terrible choice. And it put many people to a terrible choice. I think most people in Georgia decided to vote for Warnock, including many Jewish voters and many pro-Israel voters. They prioritized putting the Democrats in charge of the Senate over support for Israel, or they thought maybe Warnock, since he only has a 2-year term, he has to run again in 2 years, will behave himself for the next 2 years and not allow his what appears to be deep anti-Israel bias to manifest itself, and instead will express the platitudes that he expressed to get himself elected. So those are the choices we're faced with today, and I don't like the choices. I'm not happy with them, and I'm going to continue to fight within the Democratic Party to make sure that politicians like the Reverend Warnock are marginalized and not elected to the Senate. But he was elected to the Senate, and I hope he will serve with distinction, honestly, and without the bias that he obviously has deep in his heart. Okay, so for the next question, welcome to Rumble Dersh. We may not agree on many issues of politics, but we agree on the big things, God-given rights and liberty enshrined in our Constitution. Thanks for your honesty. Look, that's what I try to do. I try to be honest. I try not to allow my personal views to influence my analysis of the Constitution, which is why I have been right more often than Larry Tribe or Jeffrey Toobin or any of the pundits on any of the major TV stations, because they always allow their wishful thinking to determine what they tell and often mislead the public. I never allow that. I will never allow my personal interest, biases, predilections to influence the way I analyze the Constitution and the way I analyze the law. So thanks for your vote of support. Next one is, you and Tulsi, obviously the senator, should build a new party. Yours is long gone. Well, my party is now in control of the House and the Senate and the presidency. So let's see how it does. Give it a chance. My view is always, when a new administration comes in, I wish it luck, and I stand in criticism when it does the wrong things. I'm going to do the same thing for the Democrats as I did for the Republicans. Next. You've got a very optimistic assessment. The Supreme Court dodged its responsibility to preserve the rule of law by refusing to hear the Texas case. 20 states have no standing. Now 75 million Trump voters think the Supreme Court is as compromised and corrupt as the rest of the establishment. Representative Gohmert's assessment of the was right, that the Supreme Court is going to leave conservatives with no other option except to become violent. I hope not. Like the leftists. Whether it comes to that depends on tomorrow. No, I don't think it does. I think you're wrong. I don't think we're going to see violence in this country. Everybody is operating within the rule of law. Senator Cruz is stretching the law, but he's operating within the rule of law. President Trump, by refusing to concede, is operating within the rule of law. He has a perfect First Amendment right to do that. Let's not resort to violence, either by the left or the right. Let's continue to stay within the rule of law. Yeah, you can be an advocate. You can stretch the Constitution. You can pull and tug at it, but don't rip it up. And don't go to the extreme of violence. We have recourse. The Supreme Court is not a corrupted institution. The best evidence of that is that the three justices appointed by President Trump voted against him. I happen to disagree with the three justices. I happen to agree, in large part, with Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, who I rarely agree with. But I happen to agree that on the issue of standing, I think Texas could have standing, depending on the circumstances of the case. And I do think the Supreme Court made a conscious decision not to throw itself into the thicket of politics by getting involved in that case, especially since that case did not, in the view of the Supreme Court, provide a realistic route to overturning the election. Okay, our final question. If it is determined that the election was fraudulent, let's say in Michigan, does that mean that the down-ballot races need a remedy too? What a great question. I don't think very many people have thought about that. I mean, obviously, if there were to be a determination that the computers were corrupt or fraudulent, you'd have to have a remedy for all the people who were influenced or impacted by the fraud. I don't think we're going to find that. I do think even after the election is over, we're going to see, even after we have a new president and new Senate, we're going to see continued investigations. Historians, scientists are going to continue to look into the issue. And if it were to turn out there was massive fraud, this really, you're not going to undo elections at this point. Even if it were to turn out hypothetically, which it won't, but even if it were to turn out hypothetically that the incumbent president and vice president participated in the fraud, that might or might not be an impeachable offense, because we don't know whether or not conduct leading up to an election by a president-elect but not a president or a candidate would be a basis for impeachment. The Constitution doesn't say. It just says high crimes, misdemeanors, bribery, and treason. It doesn't say when. We do know that that while he was the sitting vice president of the United States, Aaron Burr engaged and committed a crime of homicide. He killed Alexander Hamilton against the law of New Jersey, and he was not impeached because his term was basically coming to an end. He was then indicted for treason, partly defended himself, and won a very strange verdict. The verdict was not a verdict of not guilty, which is the traditional verdict. The verdict rendered by the jury was not proven, the Scottish verdict, which Burr then asked to have changed to not guilty, and the Chief Justice of the United States, John Marshall, refused to change it, and it went down in history as a not proven verdict, unusual in the annals of our trial system. But what great questions. Hey, I miss teaching. I miss teaching at Harvard, but I think I have just as good students out there today. And so what a pleasure to join with you in discussing the constitutional issues that dominate the news. Yesterday's news, today's news, tomorrow's news. So continue to watch The Dirr Show on Rumble or any of the other platforms. Continue to send in your questions, and I'll continue to engage in a Socratic or maybe a Talmudic dialogue with you about the Constitution, the rule of law, politics, and morality. All that on The Dirr Show.